Hi all, welcome to Anime Echoes. So we'll be continuing on with the 7th volume of Bakano. So we start off and Christopher's basically coming up to the floor where Firo is with his foot down on Dallas. So he appears and he's appreciating nature. Christopher loves nature. The second he walks in, he can't help but talk about nature. So it's clearly super fundamental to his character. Anyway, he recognizes Firo, and Firo's like, damn, this guy's here. Because he asked for Firo, everyone's eyes are now on Firo. So many of the people who are just on the floor eating or just looking around, their eyes are on Firo. Everyone else, like Jacuzzi, Nice, Donnie, all those guys, their eyes are on Firo. And now he's kind of annoyed because all the attention's on him, even though that's not what he wanted. Though Ronnie seems to have the same expression, so there's no shock or startling in Ronnie. So we get, more into Ronnie's perception or how he sees things, which is pretty calm. He seems very composed. It was implied before that he potentially could see the future, but he's not going to. So he seems to be doing pretty okay, which shows just how much of an onlooker he kind of wants to be within majority of the scenarios and just how omnipotent he actually is. Now, either way, Christopher asks for the manager. So the manager comes out and immediately he proceeds to shoot him in the head instantaneously. So the guy's just dead. Everyone's in shock for this one. Though not Ronnie as well. He's also pretty calm in this, though we don't actually get to see his expression, but we can assume he's also got the same expression still. But either way, everyone else is in complete shock. Now, during this scene, Donnie goes to attack Christopher. So he gets a table and he hurls it at him. Now, Christopher's almost acrobatic like Claire. He proceeds to bend his body back and arch it all the way back to be 90 degrees, to have a 90 degrees angle with the floor. And because of this, the table flies over right above his nose. So he ends up being able to dodge that massive table. Now, he tries to kill Donnie, but Nice throws a flash bomb in his face. And then Jacuzzi tries to go get his gun, but then gets stopped by Adele. Now, Adele apologizes, but she's clearly smiling. She's enjoying it. We know this about all the Lamia people. They like to, kill people. They like to see a lot of blood. It's everything they want to see. So, not that surprising from Adele. Now, Firo yells for everyone to stop. He says, "What are you doing, Christopher?" Christopher says, "This is my job. This is what I do." Firo proposes that he take him hostage instead of Jacuzzi, but Christopher says, "No, you'd be a lousy hostage because you're a mortal." So Christopher knows. So I get the feeling that Christopher's always knew that Firo was an immortal. That was my first impression, that it wasn't a coincidence, though I wasn't 100% sure either. But we learn more about whether he immediately knew that Firo was immortal or not. And we get that answer later, so we'll go into that later. But yeah, I thought this entire scene was pretty shocking. I really didn't expect him to just immediately try to kill the manager. Though it does make sense. When he did ask for the manager, I was like, well, this guy's probably a Nebula employee, so he's going to attack him. But even then, even though I knew it was going to come about, it was still pretty shocking and surprising. Now, the next scene is very interesting. So we jump to Chi, and he looks at Nick and Jack, who are creeping around on the floor. He's thinking, well, they must be the sacrificial pawns that Tim was talking about. But then something clicks in his mind. He's looking around and he probably sees that something's missing just based on the reveal later. But yeah, he then starts darting up the stairs crazy. And he's jetting up the stairs. So he's going at the same speed as an escalator. So that's pretty fast. And he yells to Christopher, "Run." He also thinks, did Master Huey know about this? What is going on? So when I was reading this scene, I thought that was pretty incredible. It really made me think, what the hell? What is going on? Especially seeing Lamia, their group, on the back foot and to be surprised. This entire volume, they've been just a force of nature, I think. Especially with Christopher. They've all had this kind of presence about them. So to actually see Chi get scared and to be worried, all of the Lamia group's always teasing Tim and stuff like that as well. So to see him actually get scared, I couldn't help but think, wait, something is happening in this place that is making them scared? it must be something crazy. And I think we find out it is pretty nuts. Now, the next scene, we jump to Tim, and he thinks he's found the lab. So the lab where they're doing the experiments for immortality, basically. Then, completely contrary to what Tim was thinking, the Senator Barium comes out of nowhere and then says that him and Nebula go way back. So now we know that Senator Barium is in cahoots with Nebula. So this is really interesting. So he's not just some sort of senator, right? And he wasn't here just to eat food because it's a pretty luxurious place as well. He's here because he has dealings with the underworld, or, you know, I'm guessing like Nebula has ties to like, you know, shady stuff, right? I mean, clearly, you know, they're dabbling in pretty, like if Huey's group is like interacting with you in some way, most likely there is some sort of underworld affiliation. But yeah, either way, the senator says that this was a trick he played on Huey's men, and specifically Huey's handmade protege. Now, it's interesting to think that Tim is Huey's handmade protege. Now, like Christopher says that Tim is like a kind of like a replica of Huey, but just kind of tempered down and not as interesting, I guess. But from Lamia's perspective, we've always never really seen Tim as that great or that amazing. But from the perspective of the senator, he seems to be considered a protege. So that's pretty big, right? Like before I was thinking, oh, Huey's just using Tim, but maybe that's not the case. He could actually be talking about Christopher. Like, we don't actually know who the protege is. Though Christopher's personality doesn't really match Huey's in any way, and he doesn't seem to be going in any direction that implies that he would be Huey's protege. Like, Tim fits the protege archetype. But yeah, we'll have to see what he actually means about that. But basically what the Senate is saying is that they thought, so Lamia's team thought, that Nebula would be Huey's experiment. But turns out it was just a lure, right, to get them into this facility. Turns out Nebula wasn't the guinea pigs. In fact, they were. So this was a really interesting twist, because now it's like, well, this corporation that I didn't really think was that much of a threat at all, like I just thought it was the backdrop for what's going on. Like now it's like, wait, who are these guys? And what have they actually done? And at this point, the mystery was really building and it was getting really, really interesting. This was when I was like, I think this is the most I've been into this novel, and this novel's been great, but I think just this entire scene in Miss Hall has been just really, really fun. So we'll be going into the next scene now. Now we jump back to Christopher and Fira, and Fira's like, you knew? Like, you knew I was an immortal? And Christopher says that he didn't know from the start. So this is really interesting, and I kind of like this. I didn't want Christopher to immediately know that Fira was immortal. I don't really know why I didn't want that to happen, but I just kind of like this outcome. And then, ding, the elevator opens. Now, Christopher inspects, and out comes Ennis. So that was Ennis from before, and holy crap, she's powerful. Like, she, like, clicked, like, she kicked a door cleanly off, and she kicks Christopher in the face, though we do find out that he didn't really suffer much damage. So, you know, like, if we're gonna, like, scale how strong these characters are, they might be on a similar level. I'm guessing Ennis can also take a punch if she can kick a door that hard. And also it's a really nice scene because Ennis and Fira finally get to reunite, but this is obviously not the moment. Like, they're definitely going to have a moment, Fira and Ennis, and it's going to have to do with like Ennis's thoughts about their relationship and stuff like that, and Fira's worries, and you know, all of that is going to come to a head later on. I'm sure there's going to be a scene, so I'm keen for that. But yeah, we'll have to jump back to Christopher, and what Christopher's saying is that not even his parents have hit him. Not that he has any, though. So this is where we start unraveling that, well, what Christopher actually is. He says that he's very similar to Ennis. So at this moment, it was like homunculus confirmed. But I did want to have some sort of difference, right? Because in the fifth novel, we also have homunculi, I think, in that novel as well. So I was like, you know, let's change it up a little bit. You know, what's different about him? And Christopher says that he's the little sister to Ennis, but not like directly, right? Because he's a failed research experiment. He's a failed homunculi. And the difference is that Ennis is undying and unaging, and they're just unaging. And what that means is that they don't need to have a main body. So I didn't really understand what they meant by main body at that point, but There is a line where Enna says that when she meets Fero in this moment, that she met her main body. So I think what this means is it's actually required for Ennis that Fero to stay alive. Like, I think they're like fundamentally connected in some way. Just in the background of this scene, Isaac and Mira kind of disappear as well. Anyway, going back to the scene at hand, Fero asks, so Zillid isn't the one who created you? And then Christopher says that created is a nice thing to say because it's treating him as a proper human instead of someone who's artificial. Now, this is clearly how Fear is going to think. He's clearly in love with Ennis. He would not consider another homunculus to be non-human because that would be considering Ennis to be non-human. So Fear would never think that. And I guess Christopher kind of appreciates that to some degree, but you also get the feeling that he's kind of just laughing around, so we don't really know if he actually really appreciated that moment. Now, either way, Christopher, here's another ding, right? Another escalator has come up, and he throws knives, and out comes Claire. Now, this was good scene. Like, there's an amazing picture in the novel as well, and it's really well drawn. You get to see, Tick, and, Chane. In the background as well, so that part was really, really cool. And yeah, it's really good use of the escalator. Like, every time you hear the ding or you see the ding, it showcases that a new character's gonna arise, a new scene's gonna arise. So it was really, really solid to watch, to read. Now Claire comes out, and Claire meets Fero, and this is a pretty nice scene. And Claire says, I haven't seen your baby face in years. Now Ennis is very startled about Fero's response, because when he hears that, Fero just kind of laughs it off, because Ennis knows that Fero is actually insecure about his baby face. Apparently he's destroyed some guy's fingers at a casino because they called him babyface, so he completely annihilated them. So seeing this interaction that doesn't really fit, Ennis is like, this guy must be someone special. Now just during the scene, Isaac and Mira are also back, and they're just wreaking havoc as always. But this is the part that takes anyone aback when they're reading. So the manager gets back up. Now, I was so confused, and he wasn't hurt. And then Christopher looks at his knife gun, and there's no blood on it. And the blood from the Nebula employees vanished from the first floor. Now, Chi comes up announcing a huge reveal that everyone in the Nebula Corporation are immortals. And this is what Senator Barium meant. The entire corporation, this entire building, has been the experiment. That they're all immortals. And because of that, Chi thinks that Christopher and their group need to get the hell out of there. Because basically, they can't kill anyone there. Now, we know about Christopher's group. They are unaging, right? Unaging. And they don't need a main body. But they are not undying. This is not a fight that they can win. So this is huge. This is really big. This was really, really fun. I'm really getting into this last scene. So many characters, so many things happening. Really looking forward to seeing what's next. I'm having trouble like speculating because I feel like the tables keep getting turned over again and again as I'm jumping between scenes. So yeah, honestly, I'm just in it for the ride. So yeah, keen to see what happens next. So basically, we end up finding out that there's a deranged female scientist, and it's because of her that all of like the Nebula employees ended up getting injected with a vaccine. So we find out that she's injected 1,200 of them. I'm really curious to see like who this female scientist is. I think we'll actually get to meet her, but I'm really keen to see who this is and why they did such a thing. If there's members within the Nebula Corporation, like people who are really, really high up that are going to be really important to the story as it goes on. We'll have to see where that goes. Now, it's implied that Huey might have actually known this was the case, and that's why he actually allowed for Christopher and his gang to like run amok to create some sort of chaos, that this might actually be all part of Huey's plan. That the Zillid Quates incident, the flying pussyfoot, like, everything's part of this plan, and everyone is caught in a web that Huey and Nebula are both dangling. So they're kind of, like, fighting each other, and everyone's, like, caught in between it all. Now, during this entire scene, so we're hearing this all from Senator Barium, you kind of have to wonder, like, what's the senator actually up to? Now, after hearing all of this, Tim comes to the conclusion that he needs to get the hell out of there, and that after talking to him, to Senator Barham, he's gonna go to Jacuzzi in Dallas and just leave. Now, back to the scene where Chi basically runs in and says that everyone's immortal. This actually gets a response out of Ronnie. So all this time, Ronnie's been really calm. He's just been observing. And now this actually makes his eye twitch, which is really, really interesting. Why would his eyes twitch? Maybe because it's talking about immortality. Maybe that's the one thing that he actually cares about, because maybe he is the demon. But we'll have to see. Now, we get to mention that this, like, Christopher and the gang, they're running on Huey's orders. So once Huey's been mentioned, Chane knows that this is about Huey. Now, despite G's pleas for Christopher to get out of there and for them all to basically dip out of this Nebula Corporation situation that they're in, Christopher says, well, simple. Why don't we just have Ennis and Fero eat them? They both have the power to do such a thing. And Fero says for Ennis to, like, not listen to Christopher's babble. Christopher explains that what Huey is interested in the past, the formula for a complete homunculus, which he knows that Fero knows. Now, Ennis and Fero basically go to go away, and then Adele attacks, but then Vino stops her, like stops the blade from like reaching them. And right after that, there's kind of like a little bit of back and forth, but then Christopher ends up shooting at Vino. So Vino ends up deflecting that bullet from Christopher with the spear. So, and the spear is Adele's, and it ricochets and he ends up grazing Adele in the face, just like Chane. And he says that, you know, I guess things are even now. The reason why he says this is because Chane also got grazed by her. So, you know, they're both even now, basically. Now Tim comes up and he's frustrated. He says the mission's out. We need to go. And he tells Christopher that he'll take responsibility as well. And then Christopher says, okay then, and then proceeds to kick Vino. Now they fight for a bit, and Vino praises him actually, and says that he's the third strongest after himself and after Felix. So this is like the first time we've seen like Claire get actually like hurt in any capacity, or to get a kick, or to get kicked. Like, it's the first time we've actually seen him actually take some sort of damage. Which is kind of crazy to actually think about. So that was genuinely like really, really shocking. But it's also really good to see, because you don't want to see Claire being like this really invisible guy all the time. Like, that would just get old. So seeing him actually getting pushed back even a little by Christopher is really, really fun. Now, Christopher says that he wants to challenge God. And since God loves Vino, which is also a really interesting line, because we know that Claire thinks that he is the center of the world and effectively sees himself kind of as like a God kind of figure, or like the, you know, like the middle point of everything. So it's interesting that Christopher like immediately kind of jumps on board with that and says that he wants to challenge God. So I thought that was a really interesting line. And he says that I want to kill you to destroy my complex over being something humans created. So in essence, if he beats someone like Vino, then he can kind of push back on this complex of being something like artificial. Like, he did something amazing. He kicked the ass of someone who's loved by God, and that would basically validify his existence in some capacity. So yeah, I thought that was pretty cool as well. Now, after some little back and forth fighting, Vino says that it's getting kind of cramped in the space that they're in, and that they should take it outside. And that Jacuzzi and the gang might get involved because of this. So he smashes a window and he just kind of dips out. And Christopher's like, huh, you're kind of crazy. And then follows him. And then Chi follows Christopher. And then Chane does too. So four people have just left. Now, after seeing this, we see that Tick and Maria have been actually just sitting at the diner the entire time. Now, Tim couldn't do anything to stop them from going. So overall, we can see just how powerless Tim is. But I think, you know, at the end of the scene, it was actually really interesting to hear that Maria was just sitting there, and we actually get a window into her thought process basically in the next scene. I remember when I finished kind of like this section of the story, I was like, wow, Maria's just sitting there. I mean, Tick just sitting there and not saying anything makes a lot of sense, but Maria's generally really impulsive and wants to get into the action. But because of her defeat, it kind of makes sense that she might be like frozen to some capacity. But yeah, let's get into the next scene, which basically goes into that. So Maria's questioning why she didn't jump in. Like, the second she saw Pharaoh, so she's been sitting there for ages. And say to Adele that your opponent is me. She was relieved, actually. She says this to herself. She was relieved that Vino stepped in, that Claire stepped in. And she, you know, she feels bad about that she felt that relief, you know, because feeling that relief as a swordsman, as someone who uses the blade, is basically like admitting defeat. And she wants to keep faith in her blade, in that blade that she holds so dear. So to see her having these thoughts is very frustrating for her. Now, one thing that's kind of similar or interesting is that Adele also felt frightened by Vino, just like Maria did back in the day. And she didn't think anyone could stop her spear with her bare hands. And now Adele's like shaking a little. And she tells Tim that she's sure that if she kills, then her shaking and her anxiousness will actually go away. Now, this feels similar to what's going on with Maria as well. You know, like she wants to kind of make herself feel better about herself by kind of defeating someone, kind of killing someone, doing something like that to kind of make her feel okay with the fact that she lost so badly. So in effect, I think for Maria, right, for Maria, Adele is that figure that she needs to beat. But then for Adele, she, like, because she knows that she can't actually be Vino, like, whatsoever, she needs to kind of redeem herself. So in some capacity, they're both trying to, like, redeem herself, which I thought was, like, really interesting as well. Now, Adele goes to strike Jacuzzi, and we get, like, this really nice panel that's, like, drawn. And also, like, the last bit is we go back to Eve, which is actually really cool. I was hoping we'd get something from Eve instead of her just kind of chilling outside, waiting for things to happen, or just waiting for Dallas to kind of show up and just having them reunite. I think it's a nice way to actually, I don't know, like get some sort of commentary from Eve, or to just use her as like the eyes of the situation, which is what he does right now. So it says that Eve saw like a rain of blood and a mysterious figure on the side that was covered in blood. Now, I was thinking like, oh, it's just like, covered in blood, or is it actually like a red figure? Like, could this actually be Ronnie? Could he have, you know, if he's the demon, could he have come out? Or was it like Vino and the rest of them? Like, did they, like, who's being hurt right now? That's what I was thinking. And immediately my mind went to like the rail tracer, right? Like, he was covered in blood and everyone thought he was some sort of like vicious monster. But generally when they saw him, he was always covered in blood. But you know, like, it was covered in the blood of his victim. So I thought, whoa, has he already, like, hurt Christopher really, really badly? What's going on? And we get answers to that in the next scene. Now, we jump into Christopher's perspective, and he's basically talking about this idea of getting soaked by nature, you know, with the rain. And he says that, in effect, because he's letting the rain pour on him, that he's coexisting with nature. And he says, like, what a shame since you're... Oh, sorry, what's his name? Claire says, what a shame because you're between them. The ground and the rain have to part in tears. And Christopher says, I didn't expect that kind of comment from you. I just thought that was a really interesting idea. They're both very willing to get into each other's worldview. Like in the previous scene, Christopher was talking about how defeating Vina would be like him kind of beating God in some way. And that kind of goes into Claire's character or Vina's character and how he thinks about himself. Now we see Claire actually going into the perspective of Christopher and really kind of just, you know, kind of just having an exchange with him. Like, he's not like, what are you talking about? None of that makes sense. He's just basically going, okay, so this is how this guy thinks. Let me just kind of indulge him. Not even indulge him. He's just kind of having a back and forth and basically accepting that Christopher's point of view is his point of view. So I think that's a really interesting kind of similarity that we got going between the two characters. Now, this is pretty big. We find out that Vino is actually the one that's hurt. So that's huge. So it's not like someone else's blood, right? Like in the rail tracer situation. It's his blood. So I think that's a big deal. Now we learn how this happened, right? Actually, right before we get into that, they're having this conversation about how strong each person is. And Vino says he doesn't really care. Like, he's bleeding a lot, but he just doesn't care. And Christopher says that if he gets to... like, if Vina gets to beat him, then he can actually go and brag to the rest of Lamia. Then Vina says, okay, cool. Like, how do you rank in that squad? And then Christopher says he doesn't know. And Vina says, you can't beat me. And Christopher says that for 50 years, he's killed and killed. In fact, in his dreams, he does that too. Like, he's killed people like 20 times more in his dreams than he has in real life. And turns out he's killed like 500 people. And because he's having these dreams, his grip on reality is kind of fuzzy. Like, he can't really differentiate between reality and dreams anymore. Now, Christopher's asking, like, what do you think of that? Like, what do you think of me? And Vina just says his eyes and teeth are cool. And Christopher says that just like before, so like when he ducked that question, you know, where do you rank within Lamia, when Vina was asking that, Christopher kind of dodged that question. Just like this, like Vina ends up dodging this question as well. So they're kind of having that kind of interesting interaction and banter. Now, we find out that Christopher no longer has any bullets, and Vina asks him if he's thought a way of beating him. And grinning, Christopher says, not at all. So this entire scene is really interesting. And we find out the reason why Vina ended up getting hurt is because, like there was like a ricochet of like the bullet and he ended up hitting him. But yeah, this entire interaction is kind of interesting. It's also kind of confusing, but at the same time, you really get the vibe that these two guys, they're kind of on like a similar wavelength. And that's what makes it really interesting. You still get the impression that Vina has the upper hand and that Christopher just isn't as strong as Vina, despite what's happening. Like, even though Vina is really injured right now, I don't think Christopher's actually on the front foot when it comes to this fight. I mean, he could be, but like when Christopher says like not at all, I think that is a genuine kind of expression of like, I actually don't know how to beat you just yet. So yeah, I thought this entire fight is really exciting and I'm keen to see what happens next. Now we jump back to Maria and Jacuzzi and Adele and all those guys, Tim. And basically Maria's like stopped the blade from reaching Jacuzzi's face. So that's what we kind of saw in that image. And she thinks to herself like, yes, I did it. And now I can't go back. Like, she started the fight with Adele. Now, Adele starts, like, swinging her blade in, like, a circle, and, like, Maria barely dodges it. Fira comments on how she swings it around like a child, and it's noted that Adele probably learned how to use the spear just from instinct, so she was, like, self-taught. She just kind of kept practicing and practicing and practicing all on her own. And because it is, like, personal and self-taught, her childish swings, even though they are childish and they don't really have that, you know, that finesse of being like a master or anything like that, she's probably done it so much that it's like comes with like a real sense of ferocity when she attacks. Now, we have another parallel between Maria and Adele, which is that Maria is also self-taught, right? She's also self-taught about the blade. So once again, we get these like kind of like the kind of mirrors of each other to some degree, except Adele's kind of more crazy. And I mean, Maria's pretty crazy as well, but she's I don't know, she's more like just very, I don't know, vibrant personality, while Adele is just very much like a crazy person. I mean, probably, right? We might learn more about her that makes her more sympathetic, but for now, she's just kind of like a crazy Lamia member who's like very, who has a lot of bloodlust. And yet, Maria wants to really kind of believe in her blade and a katana. Yeah, and Fira notices that all of the Lamia members are crazy, and they're like nothing compared to Ennis. But Ennis says there's one missing, and where the hell is Lisa? You know, where is she? She's always kind of in the darkness. Who is she? She's very mysterious. And I was thinking the same thing. Like, as I was reading, I'm like, where is she? Like, what is she doing? For a second, I thought that she might be, I don't know, like she might actually have a mission on her own. She can kind of get under the skin of people. She can hurt them really badly. I was wondering if, like, Lisa's apparently, like, even more loyal to Christopher. I mean, sorry, even more loyal to Huey than Christopher is. At least it's implied in a certain section. Though Christopher kind of took some sort of offense to that. Or, like, a very subtle offense. So I thought maybe, like, Lisa might be her own, like, renegade or something like that. That's what I was thinking at the time when I was reading this. But, yeah, let's go to the next section. Vina's, so we're back to, like, Vina and Christopher. And Vina's querying, like, why are you using those knife guns? Like, they're kind of half-assed as guns and as knives. Like, they just don't do the job. And Christopher's saying that he's half-assed as well, like, just as an individual, both as a natural creature and as an artificial one. Like, as an immortal, he's half-assed, he can't do everything. And as someone natural, he's also half-assed. Like, he can't really pick any of it. So it's kind of perfect for him that he gets things that are kind of imperfect. Now, after this, Christopher says, friends are great, aren't they? And he's clearly implying that something's going to happen, and that's exactly what's happening. So he implies that he's got some sort of friend kind of in the background who's about to attack, and that is exactly what happened. So Lisa attacks. So the person we were just talking about before, Lisa attacks, and she throws like a metal ring at the back of Vina's head. Now, ding, Chane saves him with her daggers, and Vina says apparently if you're engaged to them, they watch your back out in the open. So I thought that was a pretty good scene. Now in the next scene, Tick talks to Tok, and he doesn't know him. He doesn't recognize him. And he tells him to stop the fight, that it's a waste of time because both parties, so Adele and Maria, they're just trying to redeem each other, which I think is a good point. And I think it's pretty obvious this is the case. Adele's trying to redeem herself from losing to Vino, and Maria trying to redeem herself from losing to Adele. I like that Tick, even during like saying this, he has complete faith in Maria that she won't lose. Now during this interaction, Tok is getting annoyed because he knows his brother, but his brother doesn't recognize him. He's claiming, or he's saying like, hey mister, to Tok, like he's some sort of stranger. And because of this, Tok feels like the need to almost introduce himself to him, but he stops himself. He stops himself thinking, what are you doing? You threw away your past, didn't you? And he gets a flashback to what, like, Senator Barium is saying, that he's a butterfly caught in a spider's web. But he says that he'll be the strong one that eats the bloody spider. He's not going to be manipulated whatsoever. That's what he's thinking. And if he's going to do that, he can't just go back to his past at that moment. He can't just reveal himself to Tick. And that standing in this moment, though, regardless, is really, really painful. I thought this was a really good scene. It really shows like a lot of like Tok's kind of in a turmoil, especially with his brother just being right before him. You can tell like within his mind that he's really conflicted, and it's clear that everything he's been saying in the past, that he doesn't care, that he's moved on, that he's someone different. He clearly has ties to Tick. He clearly has ties to other people. His past. And he can't just like dismiss it outright. And that's why standing there is so painful for him. So yeah, I thought that was a good scene. Now the next scene is Vino versus Christopher. So we find out just kind of a general thing about Lamia. And what it is that it has personalities that were practically like formed by Huey's experiments. And we focus on Adele and we find out that she wasn't really taught anything. She wasn't really considered to be special or useful. In fact, she was considered to be useless from the start, and she was only used in the human experimentations. And generally what she does is she helps like Christopher out with work or works with Tim, things like that. Though we get a little tidbit into her character, which is that she thinks that she'll finally feel accepted if she kills people. So I thought that was like a really interesting tidbit about her character. We can finally see something that shows us a more like vulnerable perspective about Adele. Before she seems kind of crazy, she was always timid, I guess. Like she never really gave off the same aura as Christopher or Lisa or Chi. She always did seem like kind of secondary within the group. Also compared to Lisa. Yeah, I mean, I already just mentioned Lisa. So yeah, compared to that group, she did seem like very secondary. But it is really interesting that she wants to like prove herself in some capacity, or she wants to feel accepted. It seems like her willingness to... Not willingness, sorry, but her want to be accepted is also tied with her need to like prove herself against Vino, right? If she can't kill someone like Vino, then how's she going to be accepted? I think that might be like her thought process. So for her, it might be like almost like a fear of abandonment by everyone else, that she'll be considered useless because she couldn't beat someone. And she feels a need to have to redeem herself because of that. Now we move on to Lisa and Chane, and Lisa finally says hi to Chane and talks to her, but really what she does is she taunts her and says that if she had to choose, would she pick Huey or Claire, like if she had to choose between them, and that causes a small hesitation in Chane, and Lisa uses that small hesitation to her advantage. During this moment, she attacks with four of the chakrams, and Chane like deflects them all. But then there's kind of like a fifth one that was kind of hiding, and it goes for a throat. Now Claire stops it and says that if she was actually, you know, following Huey's order, like if Chane chose Huey instead of Claire, then she can just try to kill him. And then they can kind of have like a little romantic thing going on as she tries to kill him. And he says, it sounds like true love, right? And that's basically how Claire rationalizes it. Because to him, while she can try to kill him, she's not going to do it. I have complete faith in myself and my capabilities to always come out on top, to always be the one who's alive. Like, the world revolves around me. So yeah, like, Chane can choose Huey and then keep trying to kill her. And we can kind of have this dynamic where she's trying to kill me and I'm just kind of being romantic in our fight. Now, when Claire says this, Chane looks like mildly disgusted, but then also like smiles at Claire. So you can tell that like Chane basically is like, come on. But like in like a joking way, like she understands that this is just kind of like Claire's personality. And then that's why she like smiles as well. And then Claire's still joking around and says that Lisa's true form is that way. And he like kind of throws those chakrams at Christopher. Now, Christopher's confused, right? He's like, what the hell? Why'd you throw this stuff at me and say those words? But Claire was just kind of hoping that he was like a ventriloquist all this time. And that like there was no Lisa, that I don't know, like he was making the voice for her and he was the one that was actually using those chakrams to attack. But no, obviously he's wrong. Lisa does exist. And like the scene kind of ends with both of them realizing that they're kind of at the peak of Mist Hall. So that was a pretty good scene. And yeah, I really enjoyed this scene. I really like this dynamic. There's a lot of good action going on as well. It's interesting. Like Lisa tries to kind of like manipulate Chane to some degree. Like she seems to be really good at like creating openings for herself, I think. It makes a lot of sense considering like the way she fights as well. Like she throws stuff out of nowhere. She's always in the shadows. So I feel like a lot of her personality is all about just waiting for the right opportunity to arise and then kind of attacking. I mean, it could be wrong, but I feel like that's like it might be a little bit like that action that she does or the way she's kind of designed as a character. Her always trying to like wait in the shadows and then to attack might be indicative of her character just in general. But we haven't learned a lot about Lisa, so I don't know, to be honest. But yeah, I thought this scene was really good. Now, the next scene is a big scene. You know, one of the ones we've been waiting for throughout the entire novel. So we finally get the showdown between Maria and Adele. And what a showdown it was. So Maria at the start is struggling. Like, they're kind of clashing with their weapons, with the spear and the blade. A lot of sparks are coming out of the blade. And yeah, it's pretty fierce at that moment. Now, Maria's still contemplating, you know, she's still kind of struggling. She's still thinking about the last incident that happened. And more specifically, she's really thinking about kind of taking herself out and Adele down at the same time, right? Sacrificing herself for the win. But, you know, like she had that talk with Tick before, and after that pep talk, she knows she can't do that. Now, within the scene, immortal security guards, so like basically Nebula members, come in and then Adele goes for the attack. So she's actually deviating her attention away from Maria and actually going to attack these immortals. Now, I guess by doing this, it gives like Maria some time, you know, to kind of collate her thoughts. And in the scene, Adele regains her composure and then she looks over at Ronnie. And she thinks, oh yeah, like that's the person who stopped the fight back in Millionaire's Row. The person who essentially saved her life. Like Maria knows full well that she could probably have died to Adele if it wasn't for this guy actually stopping what was happening. Now, Ronnie is very intuitive and he can read what's going on through her mind. And actually, it's probably not even intuition. Like, I'm pretty sure he can just read her mind. And he says, like, you know, you're unconsciously wanting him, I mean, wanting me to solve your problem for you. And that, and she felt like a lot of shame, like the second he said that, because he picked it up so quickly. And it's also mentioned, interestingly enough, that he has reptilian eyes. So, come on, he's definitely the demon. He has to be. Like, there's no way he's not, I don't know. I don't want to put like all my, you know, like all my eggs in like that basket, but like in my mind, he's definitely the demon. So I'm just going to stick with that. Either way, Yeah, Tick picks up on this interaction and then proclaims, and I think in a very sweet manner, that Maria won't lose and that, or like give up her blade, right? Like one of the things like Ronnie kind of brings up is her anxiousness about, you know, her swordsmanship or like her blade, the one, her blade that's really important to her. That will make Maria hesitate. But Tick's giving her, you know, like this time it's not really a pep talk, but it's more like a cheerleading moment of like Maria won't lose or give up on her blade. And Ronnie says, you know, sorry for tempting you, which is very like demonic as well. You know, like demons tend to tempt people. I feel like at this point, the author's just being like very on the nose with who Ronnie is. So, yeah. Anyway. Now, we get some information about why Maria went to the offensive towards Adele in the first place. So, it turns out Maria acted in the first place to save Jacuzzi because of Tick. Because Tick was watching, she felt indebted to him, so she acted. And she only just kind of becomes aware of that. And she wants one more push. And Tick kind of gives it to her, like, in a roundabout way. Like, Tick states again that he only believes in what he has seen. And he hasn't seen the bond between Maria and her blade. That's invisible. Like, he can't see that. But what Tick has seen is how hard Maria works. He's seen that with his own two eyes. And Tick says he believes in her, right? Because he's seen the work that she puts in. He doesn't believe in her blade. That's her job. So he'll believe in her, and she'll believe in her blade, and she'll win. And Tick proceeds to like further elaborate, and he says that, you see, that way, nobody's lonely. Now, I do wonder if this is referencing to how like Tick feels inside. Like, if we all believed in each other, then we wouldn't be lonely. If I just believed in Tok, like back then I wouldn't have killed his rat to test our bonds. Is it something like that? I mean, it could be, I don't know, we'll have to see. Anyway, like, Jacuzzi screams and that brings Maria back, right? So she's gained her confidence, you know, she got that confidence from Tick and their little discussion. And then she declares to Adele that her opponent is her. And we get a really important line. I'm sorry, Murasamiya. Up till now, I've been pushing all the work onto you. I let your strength determine whether I won or lost. And she's no longer going to be adding extra pressure on the blade. And it's her like feeling insecure about being like a swordsman this entire time, right? She felt insecure that she was no longer able to be like a swordsman, you know, able to kind of wield the blade. But in effect, by thinking that way, she was effectively blaming her swords, right? She was putting all that pressure on the swords, but she needs to put pressure on herself. And yeah, so she's realizing that she put way too much blame on the blades. And because of that, she kind of states that her blade isn't just a tool. It's her companion, right? It's a companion. And you don't put blame on your companion. You work together with them. So now because of this, she's now going to put pressure on herself. And her way to do that is she provides some really perplexed logic about how she's actually 4 times stronger than Adele instead of 2 times. And she's using it to like hype herself up, and Ronnie laughs at it as well because it's just so like kind of ridiculous. Like she says that like, I don't know, like normal swords are like 2 times stronger, but because she's got katanas, that makes them 4 times stronger. And Adele says she has to be 3 times stronger to beat her, and it's just like it doesn't make any sense. But she's obviously saying it to kind of amp herself up. So she throws her blade into the air, and it like hangs quietly, right? She's just kind of in the air, and this is her her special blade, the Murasamiya. She then pushes forward the blade with her other blade and she lunges forward. Now, Adele has no choice but to smack the incoming blade away, right? So her Murasamiya gets smacked away. But then, that's the thing, she only has one weapon. Like, Adele only has one. And she's now smacked away that blade. So her movement is done. She can't do anything else. And now, because of this, there's an opening, right? Like, Maria now comes in with her second blade and attacks her. So, because the issue before was that with the spear, like, she had so much range that Maria couldn't really do anything. But the issue is that she only uses one weapon. But Maria has 2 weapons, so all she needs to do is basically make sure her one attack only deals with one of her blades, right? It only has to deal with one of them. And that's exactly what she figures out. She solves the puzzle of the spear for her. I mean, she solves the puzzle of the spear. And because of this, she's able to close the distance and she ends up stabbing her right in the shoulder. And we get a really nice spread showcasing the surprise from Adele and like the conviction that Adele has in her eyes. It's a really good page. Now she rips through and it cuts deep and Adele falls to the ground, like very squeamishly as well. She's gushing blood and she seems terrified. And Maria immediately puts together that this is the first time Adele's been cut. And because of that, because Maria knows that she probably should have deep down died at Millionaire's Row, she leaves her alive. But I thought this tidbit was also like really interesting. You know, Adele's never been cut before. Like, that's pretty surprising, right? Like, you wouldn't really expect that from her. But maybe that was kind of a rule that she set on herself, like to always try to never be injured because, I don't know, like maybe if she gets cut in some capacity, she ends up thinking she's useless and then she'll be abandoned in some way. It could be something like that. Now, either way, Maria now smiles a genuine smile at Tick because it's her victory. And that ends up being like a really like adorable moment. Now, after that, we get a spectacular moment. So she turns around and says that she can now cut anything, even the rain. And she opens a window and then slices out. And all the rain just casts away. You see? Now, Ronnie says that it's a congratulations. Now, at this moment, I was thinking, did Ronnie do that? Does he have that kind of power? Like, how powerful is Ronnie? Or was it someone he knows that can do that? Like, take away the clouds? Like, what kind of power does Ronnie actually have? Because I feel like it was heavily implied in that scene that he's the one who did it. But yeah, it's a really fun way to end Marie's victory because regardless of whether it was Ronnie or not, it feels very deserved. After that, Tim runs to save Adele. And that's kind of how it ends. Now, I thought this was it was just a really great kind of scene. It felt really good seeing Maria get a victory over Adele. It felt good seeing Maria and Tick's dynamic. It really is the push that Marie needs. I really enjoy their dynamic, and I also think it's funny that Tick tries to, like, psychoanalyze her again after her victory, and Marie's just like, shut up, and just let me be happy, right? Like, Tick has a tendency to, like, constantly explain things over and over again, even if, like, the mood doesn't call for it. Sometimes it's really useful, especially if you need, like, really good feedback, which he does give to Maria. But at this moment, you know, she's won, she's got a victory, that's all she needs right now. It's a funny dynamic, and it's really cute as well. Now, since Adele didn't die, I'm guessing we'll be seeing her again. I honestly thought that Adele would only last this novel. She was kind of like a one-and-done kind of villain for Maria to beat. But especially with, like, some of her character kind of coming out, like, recent, like, within this scene. And the previous scene, you know, us getting to know that she has insecurities about, like, being useless and having to, like, basically kind of prove her existence by being a killing machine. I think she'll be like an interesting character to kind of further explore as time goes on. We'll have to see. And now with Tim in the scene, I'm pretty sure the next big scene will be between Tick and Tim. And I can't wait for that. I really want them to, connect. And I feel like we are in like the resolution part of the story. And we're going to be getting some like insanely good stuff. Like obviously this was a huge, huge scene. And we're just going to get payoff after payoff after payoff. Until we hit the epilogue, I'm guessing. All of this was really, really good. This entire scene was great. It was very, written in a very easy-to-read fashion, and, like, I could, like, really visualize it in my head. So I really enjoyed all of it. And just all of the dynamics that were set up and everything, like, everything paid off in a way that was really, really fun. You know, like, true to Marie's character, like, with her, like, kind of cutting the rain away and everything disappearing, you know, like, it's so ridiculous, but it just makes it really, really entertaining and fun. And it still holds like some like depth to it. Like it feels like it's really earned. I really enjoyed it.